Good afternoon. Welcome once again to Line 1, your health connection. To what degree should we be worried about the effect of various chemicals on human reproductive health? I'm your host, Dr. Thad Woodard, and today we'll be discussing this issue. In Anchorage, if you've got questions or comments, call us at 550-8433. Our toll-free number, 1-888-353-5752. And you can email us during the program at line1, L-I-N-E-O-N-E, all one word, at kska.org. My guest today is Sarah Jansen. She's a physician and a PhD graduate, and now works for the Natural Resources Defense Council. We will be discussing the various effects of chemicals on reproductive health. She completed her MD and PhD in reproductive physiology at the University of Illinois in 2001, did some residency training at the University of California, San Francisco, and then got an MPH in environmental health at the University of California, Berkeley. Dr. Jansen provides scientific expertise for policy and regulatory decisions on a number of toxic chemicals, including what are known as endocrine disruptors, which we'll discuss later in the program. Dr. Jansen, welcome to Line 1.
Thank you for having me.
You know, I sometimes look at where the training was, and you look like you were born and bred to be in this issue. Tell us a little bit about your training.
Well, yes, I did all my training in Illinois, and after I finished my undergraduate degree, I moved down the road to the University of Illinois, where, you know, really what it came down to is I couldn't decide if I wanted to go to medical school or to graduate school, and so I did both. I spent the next 10 years doing both my medical degree and my graduate studies and eventually a PhD in reproductive biology, and I focused on my graduate research focused on understanding the role of estrogen in male reproduction, and it turns out that males, including human males, actually need estrogen to be fertile, which then led to my interest in how chemicals in the environment that mimic estrogens might be interfering with male reproduction and development.
Did you know, to me it begs the question, did you somewhere before you got into the estrogen and the human reproduction have something that interested you, or was this that led you in this sequence of studies to understand things, or did that happen somewhere along the line in your training? You said you already kind of had decided to be an MD, PhD, early on. Was there something in reproductive medicine that was appealing at that point, at that decision?
Well, I think what happened was around the time that I was doing my graduate training, a book came out called Our Stolen Future that was written by Dr. Theo Colburn and Dr. Pete Myers, and it talked about the impacts of hormone-disrupting chemicals on wildlife and the potential impacts on humans. And around the same time as a graduate student, I also saw a couple of seminars on the impacts of these chemicals on rodent development, including one by Dr. Fred von Saal, who was just discovering some of the estrogenic impacts of BPA or bisphenol A. And so, that got me thinking, here I am in the lab studying how normal estrogen, or estrogen that's actually normally found in males, is important for their reproduction. And here we have all these chemicals that mimic estrogen that are environmental contaminants, which also could be impacting reproduction and development. So I sort of feel like I was just in the right place at the right time to be embarking on that research. And, of course, once you start down that path, you start to learn about a lot of other things. And so, you know, looking back, I see, oh, I grew up in a family where we lived near a hospital waste incinerator. And though we had no family history of asthma, myself and my two sisters all developed asthma. And I sometimes wonder if, well, maybe it was because we grew up downwind from that medical waste incinerator, which, as I learned later on in my medical training, was a pretty unregulated business, especially when I was growing up, and probably contributed, at least if it didn't cause my asthma, at least made it worse when I was a kid.
Mm-hmm. Boy, I just have to respect anybody that's got the deep interest to pursue all that training and and get going. I mean, that's a long time without making a living. It costs a lot of money. It takes a lot of time and effort from just your personal, other personal interests. So congratulations and thanks for doing it.
Well, thank you.
Tell us also a little bit about the Natural Resources Defense Council for which you work. What's their purpose?
Yeah, so Natural Resources Defense Council, often called NRDC, is now an international organization. We are a non-governmental body. We don't receive any funding from the government. And we work on a wide range of issues, and we have offices all over the world. So I'm usually located in our San Francisco office. Today I'm calling you from our D.C. office. We also have our main office in New York and other offices in L.A. and Chicago, and we also have an office in Beijing, China now. And we work on everything from climate change and energy to endangered species and land conservation to protecting our water, especially our drinking water sources. And then I'm located in our health program, or our public health program, which focuses on a number of different issues, and, including children's health, pesticide exposures, the impacts of climate change on human health, diesel exhaust, and the impacts on respiratory problems, including asthma, especially around busy port areas in California. And most of my work focuses on chemicals and consumer products, which are known to be hormone-disrupting chemicals and also are known to be widely found in the human population because of our use of these consumer products.
Well, let's define this hormone or endocrine-disrupting chemicals. What exactly are we talking about in the mechanism with which they do that?
Well, so your hormone system is a pretty complex, we also call it the endocrine system. It's a pretty complex organ system in your body, but basically it boils down to hormones that are secreted by one organ and transported in the blood to another organ where they have their effect. So, for example, the brain secretes hormones that are circulated in the bloodstream and then have their mode of action or have their impact at the ovary or the testicles, where they might stimulate ovulation or they might stimulate the development of sperm. And there are literally dozens of different types of hormones in your body that regulate everything from reproduction, metabolism, and energy balance, which also has to do with your thyroid gland, other things that control your heart, digestion, a lot of the enzymes secreted by the pancreas, like insulin and other sugar-controlling hormones are part of your digestion. So potentially all of these hormones naturally produced by your body could be interfered with or interrupted by a chemical that might mimic that hormone, and we call that a hormone-disrupting chemical. So, for example, hormone disruptors can be intentionally made, like pharmaceuticals, and that might be a birth control pill. So we intentionally give women a chemical that mimics hormones in their body to prevent them from ovulating or to prevent a pregnancy. And that's something that, you know, has been done for many decades and is pretty well studied. But there are other chemicals in the environment, pesticides and other things added to plastics and other things in our homes, which haven't been as well studied but have been discovered along the way to mimic hormones like estrogen. And we probably understand the hormone-mimicking chemicals that interfere with reproduction and development the best, those chemicals that might interfere with estrogen or testosterone. But increasingly, we're learning about chemicals that are interfering with the fat tissue and might actually be promoting development of obesity and insulin resistance, which is a precursor to diabetes.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, next week we're going to do a program on obesity, pediatric obesity in particular, and the outcomes, and that got me back into some of this endocrine disruptors as part of the theory of why we may be seeing more problems. I guess Maybe I'll go ahead and ask you. I was going to ask the guest next week. Do we really need that to that kind of theory? I mean, it seems like we're already. It's very clear we're eating more than we have, and we're exercising less, and that seems like enough on its own to explain a lot. But maybe there's more to it, is what you're saying.
Yeah, and you know, I'm not a pediatrician, so I'll defer to you as the expert on this. But my understanding is that especially in kids and infants, we're seeing higher birth weights and higher mm-hmm. body fat in infants who, you know, mm-hmm. aren't normally exercising and don't have a lot of control over their diet. And mm-hmm. what some of the animal research is showing us is that exposures to some of these chemicals in the womb interferes with how the fat cells are laid down and where fat actually develops in your body. And we know that people, for example, who have fat in the middle of their body around their gut and their belly are at a higher risk for heart disease and other associated conditions than people who are what we call the pear shapes and have the fat distribution down lower. So one of the theories about these hormones that are interfering with fat is that they're actually laying down fat tissue in the areas of the body where it's more dangerous for development of these conditions like heart disease and diabetes.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
It's an interesting theory. I mean, we haven't studied it very well in humans, but, you know, and it's probably not a cut and dry thing. It's probably a combination of both genetics and lifestyle and exposure to chemicals in the womb.
I don't want to get off the subject too far, but since you're the internist or the adult doctor thing, there is an increasing amount of concern about what is going on in the uterus and the early childhood development that may cause diabetes, hypertension, cardiac disease later in life, and there are mechanisms being worked out for that as well. I'm sure you're aware of that.
So and actually a lot of endocrine disruptors are actually thought to cause harm because the exposure happens in the womb mm-hmm. and sets up the field for development of these diseases later in life, mm-hmm. not just the ones that you mentioned, but also cancer.
Right. Right. All right. So let me, one article that I thought was pertinent to maybe get us deeper into this topic was one I came across written by Paul Ehrlich of Stanford. He wrote this in the journal Public Library of Science Biology, April 2010. And this is a quote from his piece there addressing how we might proceed about changing environmentally destructive human behavior. He says, quote, "There also have been increasing signs of great toxic peril for humanity and its life support systems, with a growing threat from the release of hormone-disrupting chemicals that could even be shifting the human sex ratio and reducing sperm counts." So is that true, and is the concern somewhat overstated?
Well, it is true that there is increasing evidence showing that sperm counts are on the decline, and it depends a little bit on the part of the world that you're in. But to go along with that, with the reduction in sperm counts, we also have evidence for a reduction in testosterone levels in adult men. And we know that as men age, their testosterone levels tend to decline anyway, but the place that they're starting from and then having the decline is actually lower. You know, again, we go back to the theory that it's because of exposures that are happening in the womb that are causing these changes, especially in men. Along with those changes, we're seeing increased rates of testicular cancer and birth defects of the male genitals, including undescended testicles and hypospadias, which is a abnormal opening of the urethra, not at the tip of the penis, but somewhere down lower. So that cluster of effects has been called testicular dysgenesis syndrome, and is especially prevalent in developed countries around the world, especially in some northern European countries like Denmark, and then in certain parts of the U.S. it's been studied pretty thoroughly. We don't keep very good track in the U.S. of things like rates of infertility, diagnoses of endometriosis or other conditions like uterine fibroids, which are often associated with infertility. So it's hard for us to have a handle on whether it's if it's true that couples are having a harder time getting pregnant or taking a longer time to get pregnant. But we do have some troubling suggestions of that, and one in particular is a survey done of women across the U.S. every year where they're asked a series of questions about their health, including one of, have you tried to get pregnant and how long has it taken you? And increasingly, women in age groups that we typically associate with being highly fertile, which is, you know, around age 25, are reporting that they're having increasing troubles getting pregnant, which is troubling. It's not just because women are delaying childbirth until later in life. There's something going on there. And so, you know, a lot of this has been associated with chemicals in our environment, and there are a lot of chemicals in our environment because we use them in a lot of our consumer products. And I think the point of this article is that our thirst and our need to have more and bigger and better things is really at our own peril, because it's creating this environment in which humans are increasingly having lower fertility rates, higher rates of cancer and other diseases, which are probably in turn associated with these chemicals that we're bringing into our homes. Another part of the article, which I don't think is as important for this discussion, is a little bit about overpopulation in the world and that we should be curbing birth rates and also promoting not just a lowering of birth rates in the U.S. and other developed countries, but also promoting healthy pregnancies and childhood in lesser developed countries so that we maintain a cultural diversity around the world, which I think is a lofty goal, but probably not as pertinent to this discussion.
Okay. Let me remind our listeners, we're talking to Sarah Jansen today. She's an MD, PhD, working for the Natural Resources Defense Council. She's an expert on the effects of various chemicals on particularly reproductive health. That's what we're talking about. If you've got questions or comments, if you've heard about certain things, if something's happened to you and you're worried about whether there are toxic chemicals-related or drug-related problems, this might be a good time to take the time to email or call us. Our local number here in Anchorage is 550-8433. Our toll-free number, 1-888-353-5752. And you can email us as usual at lineone, lineone, at kska.org. You've listed a number of consequences on human reproduction that's being investigated now. We've not mentioned specific chemicals too much. You want to comment on some of the maybe more popular names that people have heard with in the news that are doing, they're suspected of doing some of these things?
Sure. So, people have probably heard of phthalates, which are a group of chemicals added primarily to PVC plastic to make it soft and flexible. So a rubber ducky, for example, is made out of PVC, and to make it soft and squishy, these chemicals called phthalates are added to it, or at least used to be added to them, they're added to all kinds of different PVC vinyl products, so floorboards and wallboards and vinyl interiors in our automobiles, and they're actually also used in some food processing applications. The result is that the vast majority of the population, well over 95% of us, carries residues of these phthalates in our bodies. And phthalates have been, at least some of them, have been shown to be endocrine-disrupting or hormone-disrupting chemicals that interfere with the production of testosterone, which is the male sex hormone. And when that happens during early periods of development, it results in what I was just talking about, undefended testicles, abnormal birth defects of the male genitals, decreased rates of fertility later in life, and for some of the phthalates, actually testicular cancer. So that's one of the chemicals that we're concerned about. And a recent legislation in Congress banned three phthalates permanently and three other phthalates temporarily in children's toys. But while that's great, and you know, we're eliminating one source of exposure there, for most of us, we're going to continue to be exposed to phthalates throughout our daily life, and so we really need to have better comprehensive legislation to limit exposure to these chemicals. So that's one that we work on. Another one is bisphenol A, or BPA, which is an estrogen-mimicking hormone, synthetic chemical. This chemical is used to make polycarbonate plastic, which is the clear, shatterproof plastic that used to be used to make things like the beverage, reusable beverage containers that you would take hiking, like a Nalgene bottle or something similar to that. And polycarbonate plastic you can recognize because it has a recycling triangle on the bottom of every plastic container and the number 7 with the letters PC, like polycarbonate. And so that's one use of BPA. Another big use is in the lining of food and beverage containers. So things like canned soup and vegetables and fruits and canned soda and canned beer actually all contain this chemical, bisphenol A. And it is an estrogen-like chemical, which has been associated with a wide range of health effects, including the one that we were talking about earlier, increased rates of obesity, especially in animals exposed to this early in life. It's also been associated with infertility, prostate cancer, and breast cancer. Then another group of chemicals that we work on are the so-called antibacterial or antimicrobial chemicals, which are added to things like your liquid hand soap or to powders and body washes that are advertised as being antibacterial. These chemicals are things like triclosan and triclocarban, and they actually show up on the label, unlike the phthalates and BPAs, which you really don't know if they're in your products or not. These things, because they're advertised as being antimicrobial or antibacterial, actually show up on the label of the product. So we're concerned about them because triclosan in particular is a thyroid-disrupting chemical, which and thyroid hormone is very important for regulating energy balance in adults. And in children, it's very important for development of the brain and the nervous system. And it's really just one of those chemicals that, or one of those uses of a chemical that we call a stupid use. It's not necessary. It doesn't really provide any additional benefit above just, you know, washing your hands with regular soap and water. So we think that's a use that could clearly be eliminated quite quickly and really not have any impact on public health except to benefit it. And then the fourth category of things that we work on are these chemicals called flame retardants, which are added to especially things like upholstered furniture and electronics to make them fire resistant, which is also an important public health measure. But the problem is that the chemicals don't stay bound to the product and actually come out in the dust particles in the room or the car or wherever they're being used, and people are absorbing them into their bodies. So like phthalates and BPA, the vast majority of the population, you know, close to 100% of us, carry residues of phthalates in our of flame retardants in our bodies because of their use in consumer products. So that's sort of a smattering of different things that we work on, which have been associated with hormone disruption, effects on reproduction and development.
All right, I want to come back to each of these perhaps in a little bit more detail. I do have a caller, Dr. Jensen, I want to take. Lisa, you're on line one. What can we do for you?
Hello. Well, actually, I was commenting on the list of chemicals that she was mentioning are all chemicals that I have severe allergies to, and I thought it was interesting because I do have a history of miscarriage just recently in the last 10 years. So that was just an interesting connection. But I also had a comment on population control. And I just thought it was interesting that you had mentioned overpopulation and the use of birth control pills, I think, is almost a dichotomy. I was in the School of Foreign Service, and so I'm involved in more foreign affairs type of issues. But I really believe that birth control is sort of like a Western pharmaceutical option that's really destructive to third world cultures, and I just thought it was an interesting relationship or commentary, just because I would assume that you would be opposed to using birth control pills in the third world simply because it's an introduction of a Western, kind of a Western imposed pharmaceutical solution to something that I think could be more easily, you know, natural family planning is what I advocate, because then the third world countries, you're using education, you're teaching people about their own bodies in order for them to, you know, regulate birth control, but not using pharmaceuticals that will be disruptive. So that's just my commentary, and I'll listen offline.
Okay. Thanks for your call, Lisa.
Thanks.
Yeah, thanks for your comment. Actually, I don't have any position on the use of birth control pills in the U.S. or any other country. I was just commenting on the article that Dr. Woodard mentioned, where there was a discussion in there about overpopulation and controlling birth rates, but I don't think there's actually even any mention in this article about the use of oral contraceptives. And so I'm sorry if that created that impression. I think my comment about birth control pills is they're just an example of a hormone disruptor, which is actually an intentional use of a hormone disrupting chemical. And that's really all that I was saying about them.
All right. One issue that I think is interesting to bring up is the antibacterials that you mentioned. I had not looked into that and researched it. I just have, again, my own personal bias. We see that those products or similar products, I suspect, showing up in hospitals, and there's all over the hospitals in Anchorage, there are places where you can stop and wash your hands with these things, and I didn't think about them as particularly hazardous, which they may be, but you know, soap and water has never been shown, to my knowledge, to be to help develop resistance to organisms. And I my concern about overusing these is we're just going to have more and more organisms that are going to develop resistance to these chemicals. But you're also bringing up the fact that some of these chemicals are potentially endocrine disruptors, you said, for the thyroid and hormones in particular.
Yeah, that's right. The triclosan is the one in particular that we're concerned about. That's in almost all liquid hand soaps that you can buy, you know, at your drugstore or grocery store. You know, it'd be pretty easy for you to walk in your bathroom right now and or your kitchen sink, and if you have an antibacterial soap, you'll probably find the word triclosan on the back. The alcohol or the waterless hand sanitizers, the ones that often are, you know, stuck on the wall and you can walk by and stick your hands under and it'll squirt a little bit in and you don't need to wash your hands in the sink. Those are usually alcohol-based and, as far as I know, haven't been shown to promote antibiotic resistance or to be endocrine disruptors. But it's really this use of triclosan in liquid hand soaps and things like cutting boards and mouse pads, and it's actually even in some of the clothing that we wear that's called odor resistant, which is intended to prevent bacteria, I guess, from growing in the fabric. This chemical is really quite pervasive in consumer products. Has actually, in the case of its use in personal care products like things like hand soap, has actually never been shown to be any more effective than regular soap and water if you use proper hand washing techniques. And the FDA recently stated that it not only was it not any more effective than regular soap and water, but they had concerns both about the potential for hormone disruption and for the promotion of antibiotic-resistant bacteria. So, you know, in that instance, I think this is a slam dunk. We just need to not use this chemical. We know that 75% of the U.S. population carries residues of triclosan in their body. And, you know, it's really just a senseless use of a chemical and sort of speaks to that issue of consumerism and feeling like we need to do extra things to get rid of germs when really just plain old soap and water does the job.
And soap and water works by just kind of the soaps work by raising the bacteria, viruses, whatever, off the surface, and the water just flushes them off. It's not anything highfalutin, and it works, and it doesn't develop resistance. Is that making it too simple to think about?
No, I think that's exactly right. I think from my understanding, it's just the friction of, you know, rubbing your hands together and having a little bit of soap in there to help pull them off that really does the job. And to be effective, I'm told it has to be done for 20 seconds, which is, you know, about the same as singing your ABCs or row, row, row your boat, which is what we teach our kids, you know, to do to make hand washing a little bit more fun.
Dr. Jansen, we always take a short break about this time. We're going to be gone for about a minute. I want to remind our listeners that you're listening to Line 1, Your Health Connection. In Anchorage, you can reach us at 550-8433. Our toll-free number is 1-888-353-5752. And our email address, line1@kska.org. After this break, we'll continue to take your calls and emails and talk with Dr. Sarah Jansen on Line 1, Your Health Connection. I'm Dr. Thad Woodard.
If you missed part of today's program, or if you'd like to listen to Line 1, Your Health Connection again, tune in tonight at 8. Remember, tonight's recorded rebroadcast will not be taking telephone calls. Following this afternoon's broadcast, Line 1 will be available on our website at kska.org. This is KSKA Anchorage.
Welcome back. You're listening to Line One, Your Health Connection. My guest today is Dr. Sarah Janssen. She is an expert on the effects of chemical exposures on human health, especially reproductive health. So if you've got questions or comments about things you hear today or things you've heard somewhere else, why don't you give us a call? You can reach us by email at lineone@kska.org. Our local number, 550-8433. And our toll-free number, 1-888-353-5752. And please remember, if you're listening tonight between 8 and 9 locally, you're listening to a rebroadcast. We won't be here to answer your questions. So if things are popping up in your mind you want to talk about, this is the time to call or email. Reed, you're on line one. What can we do for you? Hello, Reed, you there? Oop, we lost her. It seems to me there's always this kind of balance that maybe we ought to talk about between the economic needs of a community or society and the scientific needs of risk. And we've talked about on this program a lot about balancing the risks and benefits. And I've often said there's always risk to treatment, and you've got to balance the risk of doing something versus not doing something. And I suspect this is the bottom line of a lot of what goes on with trying to discuss legislation and develop policies regarding these chemicals. Do you want to comment on that? Does that make sense to you? Is that correct? Or are oftentimes the risk very, very clearly out of focus with some of these chemicals?
Well, when most chemicals are evaluated for their their so-called risk, the evaluation happens hopefully anyway based on the science. So, does it cause cancer? Does it cause miscarriages? Does it cause a neurological harm? And then at what level does that occur? And often we rely on an animal study to inform us about these effects. So there have to be adjustments made for converting a dose in an animal into a human dose. And then there that number is set. And then that number is used often to make what we call the risk management decision. So, okay, now we know this level is associated with XYZ risk. What are we going to do next about it? And that's where the cost-benefit things often come in. I think what's missing from that, though, is the idea that exposure to chemicals has a cost. It has a healthcare cost. And I don't think that's often quantified. You know, you and I, when we're filling out our billing forms, often don't have the choice of saying that the cancer that we're treating in our patient was caused by a particular chemical exposure. And so we have a really hard time quantifying how much, for example, lung cancer is caused by an environmental exposure versus something like smoking or exposure to secondhand smoke. And when I say an environmental exposure, I mean something like asbestos, you know, an environmental contaminant or an occupational contaminant. And so I think often the cost-benefit decisions that are made about regulating chemicals don't incorporate that cost associated with a health outcome, and they probably should. But to do that, we have to have better documentation of you know, exactly what percentages would be involved. And so I think that data would be very hard for us to get. And so really what we should be doing is making our risk management decisions based on the precautionary principle, which is that if there's evidence that a chemical is causing harm, let's reduce exposure to that chemical. And it might not mean eliminating all uses, but let's eliminate the most ridiculous uses and the ones that are likely to be causing the highest levels of exposure. And so for things like, you know, for example, if triclosan were associated with causing neurodevelopmental harm and losses of IQ points in babies who were exposed in the womb, you know, let's just get rid of it out of hand soap, and then we can talk about the things where exposures are a little bit less, like the use in your kitchen cutting board, for example. But it's one of those chemicals that we just don't need. There are some chemicals that we need in our daily lives, in order to, you know, for example, the compact fluorescent light bulbs have mercury in them. And perhaps that's, for now, until a better substitute can be found, is an essential use of that chemical. But there are other uses that just are not essential, and that's really where we need to be focusing our risk management decisions.
Okay.
That was a long-winded answer to your short question.
Yeah.
I'm sorry about that.
No. As a host on a talk show, you can't spend too much time talking. You can answer too shortly sometimes. Fred, you're on line one. What can we do for you?
I was wondering, does narcotic pain medication have anything to do with the reduction of testosterone? Because I've been on medication for a long time, and I produce next to zero testosterone, and nobody seems to know why or even be concerned.
Okay, I don't know the answer to that. Let's ask Dr. Jansen.
That's an interesting, I haven't heard that one before, but one of the uses of phthalates that I didn't talk about is in pharmaceuticals, and some of the time-release capsules or the soft capsules that are used in medications contain phthalates, and it's been shown that people who use a lot of these medications actually have higher levels of phthalates. And, of course, phthalates have been associated with the lowering of testosterone level. But I can't really, since I don't know what medications you are taking, and I'd have to look up the medication and see whether or not that capsule used phthalates, I'm not really able to comment on a direct cause and effect in your case. But,
that I could take to see what type of or how much phthalates are in my body?
Well, that's a good question. Phthalates are not a routine test that your doctor can order. It's not something that most labs are equipped to do. There are specialized labs that can do it. I can give Dr. Woodard some contact information of some labs that do it, and you could see if your physician was willing to send in your samples to be tested there. But to be honest, I'm not sure your insurance would cover it, and you might have to pay out of pocket for those tests.
Yeah, and I couldn't afford that. Okay, thank you.
What I might suggest also, if Dr. Jansen agrees, is since this issue has come up, it would be worthwhile talking to whoever's giving you the medication in concern and ask them if the narcotic has been associated with lowered testosterone. And then maybe even discussing the possibility of doing some testing for that. So I wouldn't.
Yeah, and you know, the other thing I should have said is I'm not sure if you have, because you didn't give us a thorough history there, but you should probably be evaluated by a urologist who can also look at other reasons besides exposure to a narcotic medication that might cause a lowering of testosterone levels. So you should have a full workup, and then I think that would be one of many potential reasons to cause that.
Okay, sounds good. That's a good idea.
Thanks for your call.
Thank you.
Joan, you're on line one. What can we do for you?
I just wanted you to comment if there is any relationship between the makeup used, women's makeup, and any risk effects that there might be, since it's so used by so many women.
Thank you for your question. Well, we haven't talked about it yet, but makeup does have a lot of chemicals in it. I mean, just turn over any cosmetic in your bathroom cabinet and you'll see most of the names on there you're not able to pronounce. And most of those chemicals have actually never been tested for their ability to cause cancer, reproductive harm, endocrine disruption, neurological harm, immune system damage, you name it, any toxic impact of a chemical. Most cosmetic chemicals have actually never been tested. And I think that's one of the misconceptions that a lot of us have, is that if you can buy something at Rite Aid or Walgreens or a drugstore or any grocery store, somebody is surely overseeing and making sure that that product on the shelf is safe, and it's just not the case even with cosmetics. And a lot of cosmetics actually have other ingredients that don't even show up on the label. So phthalates, for example, are often hidden in the word fragrance, because fragrance is a confidential business piece of information, and the fragrance companies don't reveal even to the cosmetic manufacturer sometimes what ingredients they're using in their fragrances. They just order fragrance number 35, and that's what shows up in their product. But we know that phthalates are used to carry fragrance, so they're found in things like perfumes and any scented product is likely to have a phthalate in it. There is something that a sister organization we work with called the Environmental Working Group runs a database called Skin Deep. and you can Google Skin Deep and or cosmetics database, and you can put all the cosmetic products you have, and it's not just for women, it has children's products and men's products as well, and you can see what how the different ingredients in your products rate according to what little information we have on most of them, and you can get a rating that's relatively easy to understand, that's, you know, a red for bad products, yellow for something in between, and then green for products which are relatively safe. But in general, the fewer ingredients on a label, the better it is, and especially if you can recognize and pronounce the names.
Are hypoallergenic, I do some asthma and allergy work and have done it for a number of years, and I know fragrances and preservatives are commonly allergens, at least with the delayed hypersensitivity reaction. So would hypoallergenic cosmetics be generally felt to be safer from a toxic standpoint, or we don't know the answer to that question?
Yeah, I don't think we know the answer to that question. You know, a lot of the toxicity concerns we have, you know, are longer term things. So what you're referring to, even the delayed hypersensitivity, is a relatively short amount of time. You know, you might have to be exposed to it over several months to develop the allergy, but usually if the application happens and then you have an allergic reaction within a couple of days. But for some of the things like phthalates, if you're a pregnant woman using these things, you might never see an impact on your own health. But then the phthalates that you're exposed to while you're pregnant are also getting into the fetus, and the fetus might have impacts later in life. Of course, we don't know that because we haven't been able to study these things as well as in humans, and it's not ethical for us to go out and expose pregnant women to a bunch of different phthalates and then watch their kids for 20 years to see what happens. But in essence, that's what we're doing already, because these things are largely unregulated in cosmetic and other consumer products. And so there are ongoing efforts to study the long-term impacts. But from our point of view, if there's evidence of harm in animals, that's good enough, and we should really be reducing exposure to begin with. And the cosmetic companies have been doing that. In fact, three different phthalates that I know of are already banned in cosmetics in the European Union, and cosmetic companies in the U.S. have slowly been phasing out the use of those phthalates here, but they've been doing it rather quietly. And if you go to the Campaign for Safe Cosmetics, you can read more information about some of those efforts. And they've actually gone out and tested cosmetic products to see which ones tend to have higher levels of phthalates and which phthalates they're finding.
Joan, you got any other questions?
Just one other quick question has to do with regulation. Should something like cosmetics, where so many millions of women use them at very young ages and for long exposures, should it be an industry that it deserves regulation for public safety?
I think so. You know, the FDA is the agency which oversees regulation of cosmetics, right. And the FDA has quite a bit on their plate. They're regulating drugs and medical devices, and they're in charge of food contaminations, and they have to respond to H1N1 flu vaccine issues. And so I think, you know, cosmetics tend to fall a little bit lower on their list of priorities. But because of things, you know, like the Campaign for Safe Cosmetics and the Skin Deep database, I think the public is becoming more aware of this problem and is demanding a little bit better oversight. And I know we're not working on it directly, but I know that Congress is working on a safe cosmetics legislation, and another group that I work with, the Breast Cancer Fund, is a sponsor of that. And so if you go to the Campaign for Safe Cosmetics website, if you just Google Campaign for Safe Cosmetics, you'll find out more information about that legislation.
Okay. Thank you.
Mm-hmm.
Thank you, Jean.
For your question.
You mentioned that the animal studies, in a sense, are, you implied, are good enough and are strongly, the evidence from animal studies is very worthwhile. Sometimes you read on other sites or in other information that just because something happens in an animal doesn't necessarily mean it's pertinent to human health. You want to comment on that issue?
Yeah. You know, like I said earlier, it's just not ethical or moral for us to be exposing humans to high amounts of chemicals to see what happens. And so we often rely on animal data to guide us. And it's true that we can't hang our hat on just one study and say, you know, this chemical is causing cancer, and you know, it's going to be causing cancer in humans as well. It's a little more complicated than that, and science is never certain. There's always conflicting studies that exist, and so just because one study shows an effect and another study doesn't mean that that first study was necessarily wrong, because there's lots of opportunities and lots of reasons why that they could be finding different results, and that could be due to genetic strain of animals, when they were dosed in their life or at different times of development, how they were dosed, if they got the chemical through their food or if it was injected into their bodies, what kind of feed they have, because a lot of animal feed has a lot of estrogen-like chemicals in it. And so really, when we think about, you know, looking at animal studies and their potential relevance to humans, we focus a lot on what we call the weight of evidence, and that is, are we seeing the same effect happening in multiple studies and multiple labs using different animals and finding similar evidence of harm? And for some chemicals like bisphenol A, we do. We have over 200 studies done in many different types of animals, mice and rodents and other animals, actually even non-human primates, which have found that bisphenol A at levels of exposure that are happening in most people's everyday lives is causing a change in the way that the brain develops, so that male monkeys behave more like female monkeys and male rats behave more like female rats when they were exposed in the womb. Similarly, we see in many different systems, both in a cell culture or a petri dish versus in an animal model versus tissue taken from a human, that bisphenol A is promoting the growth of breast cancer tissue. And, you know, it goes on and on. There's studies in prostate cancer. There's studies on infertility. And so, you know, really, bisphenol A is one of those chemicals that's interesting from a scientific perspective because it causes so many different types of harm at such low doses. But it's also, in my mind, a rather dangerous chemical because it does cause so many different problems at such low doses, and it's so ubiquitous. It's just everywhere in our environment, and it's one of those things that I feel pretty strongly. We have very good animal evidence showing harm, and based on that, we should be reducing exposure.
To those listening today, we have added the Campaign for Safe Cosmetic link to our KSKA.org/line1 website. So those who would like to go and find a link very quickly to that site, we've allowed that for you. Let's go ahead and take Reed's phone call. She's back. Reed, this is Dr. Woodard. What can we do for you?
Hi, my name is Reed, and my wife Heather and I, we've been trying to get pregnant for, I would say, at least 6 years, maybe 7 or 8. And we've been to clinics in Seattle to do IVF. Nobody can exactly say why it's not working. Spent a lot of money on this, a lot of time. But, you know, we've been trying to do the right thing, you know, and try to be healthy. And what you're saying, there's so many things out there. You just really can't watch. You can't do all the things. There's so many things out there that might affect you. You don't even know.
All right. So we need to put some perspective on this infertility issue and in relationship to chemicals, if you don't mind, Dr. Jansen.
Yeah, well, my wife Heather. She was raised in in the middle of nowhere, Alaska, raised sled dogs. So her chemical exposure has been minimal, and mm-hmm. we're both very healthy people. But one thing that you've been mentioning lately, she is big on antibacterial hand wash. She does that a lot.
Mm-hmm. Okay, well, let's get some comments.
Well, first of all, I'm sorry to hear about your fertility problems. And unfortunately, your situation is actually not much different from many couples who are trying to get pregnant. For about a third of couples, there's found to be a problem with the male side. About a third, there's a problem with the female side. And then for the remaining third, there's no good explanation for why the couple can't get pregnant. And some people suspect that's because of chemicals in the environment. It might be because of chemicals that you are exposed to now, or it could be chemicals that you were exposed to many years ago. So unfortunately, there's not a lot that you can do I don't recommend going out and getting chelation treatment or other things that I've seen, you know, people talk about doing to reduce your chemical load. Really, it comes down to a couple of simple things that you can do. You know, smoking is one. It's not good to smoke, of course, for your own health, but if you're trying to get pregnant, it's one of the no-brainers to eliminate right away, as well as being exposed to secondhand smoke. Mercury is pretty prevalent in a lot of fish products, and so mercury, you can have your mercury level checked, but if you're a big fish eater, you might want to think about reducing exposure or reducing your intake of fish while you're trying to get pregnant. And then, you know, you made a comment that your wife grew up in the middle of nowhere, Alaska, and wasn't exposed to very many chemicals. Well, that might be true if she followed a traditional sort of Western diet. But even in that case, you know, if you eat a canned food diet, you're exposed to bisphenol A. And in Alaska, I wanted to mention this since this is where your show is, that a lot of people who live in the Arctic regions actually have disproportionate levels of chemicals that we call POPs, or persistent organic pollutants, in their bodies. And that's because of the way that chemicals are carried through the atmosphere on air currents. They do this thing where we call it a grasshopper effect. So a semi-volatile chemical will evaporate a little bit. It'll be carried on wind currents. It'll come down in rain or other types of precipitation, and then it'll evaporate again, and it'll eventually will make its way up to the Arctic. So we know that a lot of the wildlife in the Arctic carries very high levels of chemicals that are not even used there. And they still carry lots of chemicals like the DDT and the PCBs. So, it is possible that that she was exposed to chemicals without necessarily intentionally or even, you know, living next to a hazardous waste site. But, I don't have any advice for how to reduce exposure to those chemicals, except to try to eat lower on the food chain, because a lot of them tend to accumulate in fatty tissue, and also to try to make sure that you're not eating fish that are contaminated with high levels of mercury. And on our website, the NRDC website, we have a mercury calculator where you can go in and enter information about how much fish you eat, what types of fish you eat, how many so-called silver fillings you have in your mouth, because those silver fillings actually contain mercury and other things, and get a sort of an idea of how much mercury you might carry in your body.
You know, we've actually done a lot of reading about that, what you're saying about, in the Arctic, having more chemicals than you would think. And, you know, we do eat sushi, and, we've done a lot of reading about that, and we've done a lot of care. You know, we've tried to do the best we can, and it's still not working, and it's a little disheartening.
Yeah.
And we're seeing there must be some chemical, something we're not seeing. You know, something we don't know about that is affecting us.
Yeah. It's of course I can't say what it might be because I don't have all your information, but
here's one more thing that to add to the I would really like to do the low T, you know, the testosterone treatment for myself, and it could possibly damage our chances, couldn't it,
having a low testosterone level?
Having
a low testosterone level is often associated with a lower sperm count. But, you know, I think it's good for you to talk about all these things with your in vitro fertility specialist, because I can't give you medical advice over the phone. It's not professional for me to do. But, you know, it's good that you're thinking about these things and trying to reduce your exposure to chemicals where we know that we're exposed now. And I'm really sorry to hear that you're going through these troubles. I wish you the best of luck.
Well, thank you. I appreciate it. And it's very informative. I'm glad you're putting on the show, and I'm listening intently and trying to get new information.
Have a good day, Reed. Thanks for your call.
Thank you.
We have about 4 minutes left. I have an email that asks about chemicals from prescription drugs and so forth that are getting into drinking water, and will filtering water help with that? And along the same line, if you don't mind, ending up with some just general advice about how we might protect ourselves from chemicals.
Sure. So for drinking water, it's true that certain parts of the country, they're finding increasing amounts of pharmaceuticals in the water. And we don't know whether or not these exposures to low levels of pharmaceutical chemicals, like, you know, not just the prescription drugs, like the high blood pressure medication and the cholesterol-lowering medication, but also things like over-the-counter medications like Tylenol or ibuprofen are showing up in water. A charcoal filter will, a charcoal-based filter will remove some of these things. So if you have a countertop pitcher that you put a charcoal filter in, you can buy those pretty much anywhere. It will remove some of the contaminants. It won't remove all of them, but you can read the label and it'll tell you what type of contaminants are removed. If you have concerns about a particular contaminant in your water, we have information, again, on the NRDC website about how to read your water quality report and measures you can take to remove specific types of contaminants, because there's not a one-size-fit-all way of filtering your water to take out contaminants, because some are different than others. So that's the short answer to that question. And the other piece of general advice I give, in addition to lowering your mercury intake by watching what types of fish you eat and making sure that you eat a diverse fish diet, you know, I wouldn't tell people not to eat fish at all, because it is a healthy protein and it helps give your body necessary omega fatty acids, which lower rates of heart disease, but to eat a variety of fish and to avoid especially those fish which are known to be high in mercury if you are trying to get pregnant or if you have a young child in your house. The other piece of advice I generally give people is when you're dusting your home, to avoid kicking up the dust into the air so that you're breathing it in. And that's because a lot of these chemical contaminants we've been talking about, the flame retardants, the phthalates, bind to dust particles where they can be either picked up by a toddler crawling on the floor who puts their hands in their mouth quite a bit, or if you're a habitual nail biter, or even if you just have a dusty house and the wind blows through and kicks up the dust, you will tend to be exposed to chemicals through that inhalation or ingestion of dust. So if you do damp dusting, instead of using a feather duster, use a damp cloth or a microfiber cloth that electrostatically picks up the dust particles. You can inhibit the dust from coming up into the air. When you're vacuuming, it's best to use a vacuum that has a HEPA filter, because that will trap some of the dust particles. And, of course, you have to change that filter regularly for it to work effectively. And then the last piece of advice I have is to take your shoes off at the door and have a pair of shoes that you wear inside, because we track a lot of chemicals from outdoors into our homes just from our shoes. And they can be pesticides that someone might use in their lawn that you walk through, heavy metals which are found in the soil, and other contaminants that tend to be outdoors are often brought into our homes because we wear our shoes inside. So if you leave your shoes at the door, you can also minimize the number of contaminants inside your home.
Dr. Jansen, thanks very much for taking the time and sharing your expertise with us today. It's been educational and enjoyable.
All right. Well, thank you. I appreciate you having me.
All right. Let me encourage everybody to go to our website, and you can pick up some of these links that you, if you want to follow this story and information a little bit further. We also remind you they're going to return next week. I'll have pediatric endocrinologist Dr. Henry Anhalt with me, and we'll be discussing the cause, treatment, and ramifications of childhood and pediatric obesity. Also would mention that the following day, on Tuesday, I'll be on Talk of Alaska with Steve Heimel, and we'll continue to follow up on this story on pediatric obesity and the consequences. Pat Yak is Vice President of APTI News and Public Media. Kristen Spacht helped me immensely today by engineering the program. I'm Dr. Thad Woodard. Have a great day.
Line 1, Your Health Connection, is a production of Alaska Public Telecommunications Incorporated, which is solely responsible for its content. Views expressed are those of the participants and do not reflect KSKA or its underwriters. Today's program is available on our website at kska.org. CD copies can be purchased by calling 550-8400. This is KSKA Anchorage.